Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now, I'm joined by Patrick Tobin, the leader of AIMTHU, Gabia Gadavascacha, who is political correspondent with the Irish Independent and Sunday Independent, and Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and member of the advisory group for the G7. And we will start off with the Sunday Independent and their Ireland Thinks poll. I'm going to lance the boil by declaring a vested interest in this particular poll because A, I'm in it, and B, I fear I'm going to get abused by the entire panel for being in it. So, Gabia, do you want to get it all, off your chest early?
Okay, so the most interesting part of the poll, just given the context that we're in now, of course, is who will get this lucrative lifeline job. And when you were reading out the 253 grand on the cash machine, I was going to say,
by
maybe that's your new salary. So look, Katie Hannon is topping the poll there for who will be the next lifeline host, followed by 16%, Brendan O'Connor, tied with 16%, Anton Savage. Yours truly presented the programme. On the actual poll, the state of the parties, I think it's quite interesting. Fine Gael, Sinn Féin are tied on 20%. Fine Gael have taken a dip by 1 percentage point, and so have Fianna Fáil. They're now on 19%. They've taken a dip by 2. We've had our week of rowing over college fees, whether or not they're going to go up, whether or not they're going to go down, and that has hit the government, and that reflects also in the party leader rankings as well. Micheál Martin, he's down by 3 points on 43%. Simon Harris is also down. I also make the point as well in my piece in the Sunday Independent how actually both of those leaders have taken hits. Now, Micheál Martin has taken a bigger hit since January. I think he was on well into the 50s in terms of his personal ranking. Simon Harris was somewhere in the mid-40s. Holly Cairns, she's a Social Democrat leader. She's still out on maternity leave. She's due to come back shortly. She's still on 38%. She's number 3 there. Ivana Bacic and Mary Lou MacDonald, no change from the previous poll. They're on 36% and 35% there, respectively. And on that row for college fees, most people believe that even though the government has cut in previous budgets the fees by €1,000, 40% think cut them even further, and 52% of the majority think that they should apply not just to people who need it most, but to people on all incomes. We're also writing about the presidential race, of course. Mairead McGuinness is roaring ahead there. You know, she's on 35% when poll respondents were asked, who would you vote for on the Fine Gael ticket? Interesting to make as well, Mary Hannafin, of course, thrown her hat into the ring in recent weeks. Her and Bertie are both tied on 17% when respondents were asked, who would you vote for on the Fianna Fáil ticket? So perhaps Fianna Fáil have to scratch their heads there and figure out, is Bertie to be totally ruled out?
Wow, okay, well, let us come back to the Auras question
in a while.
Exactly. And look at the state of the parties, because, Pat, I get confronted with this dichotomy all the time, this paradox, and I'm still failed to quite grasp to be able to wrap my head around it. Which of the following issues should be the two most important to deal with? Number one, housing. 51% of people, no change. They have thought that for the last year. They have thought that for the last 3 years. Number two, cost of living. A third of people see that as the most significant, and it was probably second most significant in the last election. How is it that the two parties with the two most popular leaders and the two neck and neck for the most popular parties in the country can be the ones responsible for what the poll says is a disaster?
See, I think there's a historical legacy to the strength of those two political parties. So if you actually look at it, Fine Gael's vote in that poll is at its lowest since 1944. Okay? Fianna Fáil's support in that particular poll is second only to its crash figure of 17% in that general election. So while they're obviously still topping the poll in terms of where they're at, they're still pretty much at historic lows. And, you know, and I think that's what's happening to a certain extent is that opposition hasn't really crystallised around a particular opposition party. I will say that AIMTHU's figures and probably Independent Ireland's figures are actually noteworthy there. That block of 11% wasn't in existence, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And it is a significant block now within the voting patterns. So I think one of the reasons why Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are there is because they're lucky. Labour, Sinn Féin are not making the impression on these figures like housing, like cost of living, that they should.
On the lower end of those numbers, and I don't mean that pejoratively, have parties like your own got the capacity to capitalise on that in terms of converting it into a vote and therefore seats?
I think so. I think, like, if you look at the last election, we reached a threshold in terms of obviously just under 4%. In about four constituencies, we were the last person standing in those constituencies for taking seats. There's no doubt in my mind that if the continued the pattern continues, we're in place for 5, 6, 7, 8 TD wins in the next general election.
Do you think you can overtake the Labour Party? Because you're even with them on popularity, according
to
this poll.
I do. I think, again, like, the legacy plays a big role in votes. Like, so if you look at, for example, the local elections analysis of Fianna Fáil, people were voting for a Fianna Fáil candidate in that local election 77% because of the candidate, and only about 23% for the actual party. As those candidates mature and they start to retire, Fianna Fáil's reach is lower. So for the likes of ourselves, people were voting, you know, for the candidate and the party in equal measure. And that's the weakness of let's say, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Many of their seats are held by people who themselves have, you know, a great level of, support within it. But when they retire, the party itself loses that support.
Although Simon Harris managed to prove and Fine Gael managed to prove that it is possible to do a fairly big upheaval and put in new candidates and retain some seats.
It has. I think that they were lucky to a certain extent in the increased number of seats that were in the Dáil in relation to that. But they're still in trouble. Like, you know, if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and that's one of the reasons why in the presidential election, I think that there's a misgivings in both parties. There's no real sense of enthusiasm in Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael at the moment in running a candidate. Fine Gael got burnt in 2011 when Gay Mitchell only got 6.5% of the vote. And right now, if either of them put up a candidate, there's a significant chance that they won't be able to take the seat, and they will spend hundreds of thousands of euro in losing a presidential election, which will increase that trend of people's, you know, attitude towards them as parties on the down.
Surely, though, Fine Gael spending hundreds of thousands to lose the presidential election is a habit long formed at this point.
I possibly agree with that. And before you go to that poll, I do have to say you're the new candidate in Lifeline and you're already at 16%.
Indeed. Thank you for bringing that
so,
back.
So, I mean, seriously, serious candidate
the
there.
My run for the Auris will rule me out for RTÉ.
Like Joe Duffy, who ruled himself out.
Did he rule himself out? Because the manner that we ruled, he said, I'm not seeking the nomination from any local or not.
No, but then he did come back and somebody said, yes, he did say, I don't want any political party and politicians to back me. And then somebody on Twitter said, does that mean that you're categorically ruling yourself out? And he replied and said, yes.
Yes,
oh,
so I think
he has ruled himself out.
I think it's very clear. And the poll with, of course, Mairead up at 27%, whatever Badr says about Fine Gael and presidential possibilities and spending money, she's obviously doing very well in the polls, very steady candidate, great record. So she's way out ahead. In terms of the state of the parties, what I think is interesting, and Padder alluded to it there, is that the opposition, like this time in previous electoral cycles, you had Sinn Féin up at maybe 36%, 30%, so on. They are very stalemated, if you like, on 20%. I think the point about the sort of state of the parties is that we are in different electoral times. We are in coalition territory. You don't have anybody way out in front anymore. But if you put Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael together, you have 39%. That's very significant. So despite the concerns, as you say, about housing and cost of living, which are absolutely real for people, and the barriers that still seem to be there in terms of front page story in the Business Post about planning stagnation, which is really disturbing, you still are getting support for stability, if you like. So it's a stable response. It's a bit like the election result.
There are two Irelands.
What we're seeing at the moment.
There are two Irelands, in truth. Like there is a section of Ireland that's doing fine. There is a section of Ireland who own their house, maybe don't have a mortgage, you don't have a child looking for a house, who are, you know, earning decent incomes or heading away on their summer holidays. And then there's this other section of Ireland where, you know, people are not sleeping at night because they don't know how to pay their bills, who are going into overdraft every single month, who are, you know, two or three kids who are travelling up from Mullingar or Portlaoise on a bus to college every day, leaving at 6:30, getting back at maybe 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And I think, you know, that's why we see the dichotomy in the actual support levels as well. But, you know, the point that you mentioned about the Business Post article on housing, I think that is one of the most frustrating aspects happening at the moment, that we're actually in reverse on so many key housing, key performance indicators. Like the idea that, you know, applications for new homes are in reverse, that actual building for new homes is in reverse. Like that story during the week that social houses, 2,000 or 3,000 of those in the Dublin area are not going to be built because each unit is topping €1 million. Mm-hmm. Like it's just absolutely mind-boggling that we've had a housing crisis now for 6 or 7 years. And actually, it's getting worse. And like we had, I'm on the infrastructure committee, and we had on Commission Plan Óla in before us during the week. And, you know, there are planning applications waiting for decisions in, on Commission Plan Óla for 16 and 17 months. The Metro North is in planning since 2022. It is absolutely mind-boggling that there's an application that's still not decided upon. And, you know, we had Ishka Aaron in the, a couple of weeks beforehand in the infrastructure committee. And I asked them, I said, when will the infrastructure gaps that are slowing down the building of homes be filled? They says they hope to have those completed by 2050. Now, the idea that most people, if you told them that the housing crisis was, would go on for another 5 years, would be in depression. But the idea that Ishka Aaron are admitting that the problems in terms of the supply of homes is not going to be really tackled until 2050.
But the other side of that
incredible.
Is if they do get the extra money they're looking for, and it may come up to 2 billion, that could make a difference, hopefully will make a difference. And the other point, and I said this before in this programme, there is a confidence in government that they will deliver the 300,000 over the 5-year period.
There's a very interesting piece done by Killian Woods talking to Brian McKeown of MKN Property Group. And what he's saying is that they have, at a time when you would figure you'd be hiring hand over fist to try to make up
the
demand.
This is very disturbing.
He says that he's let half of his staff go. He's asserting that he has a site in Swords that is ready to go. And between that and another one, he has 1,500 housing units that are zoned. He just can't get them through planning. And he said he bought £1 million worth of precast walls ready to go. And because of planning and judicial review, they're sitting in a field in Cavan growing moss.
Well, the government are absolutely. This is why Simon Harris wanted this Department of Infrastructure to pull it all together. I mean, they are definitely going to have to deal with these tangles and delays in planning, in water.
Because clock's ticking, though, isn't it?
The clock is ticking, and it's going to have very serious repercussions if it's not dealt with.
But I think that's kind of some of the rationale behind this. Housing's are that James Brown wants to hire somebody who could get in to see where the blockages are. You know, there's an obvious solution. Okay, there's homes being held up. Let me make a couple of calls. But I don't know if that's the solution. And I think people, what are probably the concerns that are growing around this is that, like, can actually government have the power to even solve the housing crisis? Like, do they have, like, are they going to ring, you know, MKM Property Group and say, actually, don't let those people go. We're going to have some more work for you coming down the tracks. There's no sign of that. The planning permissions are effectively running out. All of the state agencies seem to be at a bottleneck to one another. And I don't know if having this housing activation office is going to solve all the government's
problems. Well, can
problems.
You imagine if we were in the economic position that UK is in? At least the money is there to make a difference. Here, whether it can be activated to deal with these obstacles is the question.
Mm-hmm. How can political parties who've been in government for 14 years talk about all these issues in the future tense? And that's the really frustrating thing for people. Like, you know, we were before the election, all the talk was how the Apple tax is going to be put into building water infrastructure. There's no Apple tax being put into any water infrastructure. You know, Ishka Aaron don't even know anything about the Apple tax at the moment. That the whole process is so glacial. And one of the reasons why those builders are not building is because they can't actually make a profit out of this, which is incredible because prices are so high. In the north of Ireland, they've got rid of VAT on the construction of homes. And, you know, the logic is we should actually be at this stage looking at reducing the costs of homes so they can be built. Market activation would be included there. But like, we're a highly regulated society. So, you know, when I was raised, I was born and lived in a house that was above a garage, that was above a 2,000 gallon petrol tank, okay? Which sounds obviously very poor in terms of health and safety. At the moment, if a person wants to live above a shop in the middle of a town at the moment, regulations are so tight in terms of fire safety that in most cases they're not allowed to do so. So we're extremely highly regulated. And don't get me wrong, we do need to make sure that we live in a safe society. But the problem I have is that we can measure the danger that could happen if someone moves into a home, but we never actually measure the danger of a person not having a home. The damage that does in terms of education, nutrition, the ability of the child to socialise, the mental health issues. So we're great at finding regulation not to do things, but we ignore the actual damage that
exists
in society.
Nobody has looked for regulation more than politicians, let's face it. And I mean, we are paying the price, if you like, although I'd be slow to say this, I've said it before, of our participative democracy. I mean, in the sense of, you know, anybody, so many people can make an objection to planning. And there's a huge reluctance in the political system. Padder, and you're probably one of the people who'd be reluctant to overrule, you know, or to change in relation to planning.
We're bringing amendments to the new planning bill, which actually would stop an individual putting an objection unless they have a material interest in the location.
That's a very good
because there
amendment.
Are people in Cork at the moment putting in objections to people in Cavan.
And Donegal.
In terms of, like, so if you're a farmer building a slat of sheds in Cavan, a person in Cork can put in an objection to your application there because they might be ideologically opposed to you being a farmer and adding to the methane that's going into the environment, which is an incredible situation.
Well, this is what we call participative democracy. And unless all of us, unless the Dáil gets a handle on deciding what's more important is to build houses than to allow every single person to put in an objection. We're not going to get
but the
house
issue
built.
Is as well as that it's TDs and politicians
it's
that
local.
represent their constituents and the constituents aren't happy. And the constituents and the voters a lot of the time say, well, I don't want all this traffic on my road. I've lived in the house there for 2 decades. I've reared my kids. The house value on it probably has doubled. And I don't want the metro
there's
popping
almost,
up.
I found as a constituency a politician, there's almost an automatic reflex from the public to want to object to new housing.
But can I just say just before that? But just before
but
we get to that,
and
let's not get confused here. Metro North is still in planning. So it's not that we're in a situation the planning is true and everybody's objecting. So before we even get to the problem of all those objections, the government is still not putting in. On Commission Plan All has about 290 staff. Given the housing crisis that's there, bring the staff up to 400 or 500 people in there. Get the backlog out. You know, I'm like the idea that I'm dealing with a builder who's waiting 16 months for a planning application to come through in a housing crisis is nonsense. So most of the blockages within the system are within government departments with government ministers in charge. The idea of shuffling around and making stars of this and that and the other is nonsense. Let the ministers themselves deliver on the responsibilities they themselves have.
Although, if you remember, there was a movie called A League of Their Own in which Tom Hanks played a baseball player. It was during the Second World War. He was an alcoholic retired player who became a coach and he ended up coaching female teams by virtue of the fact that all of the men were at war and they were replaced by women to play the major leagues. And he had some coaching issues.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Yeah, there's no crying in baseball. Up until now, we thought there was no crying in parliamentary politics. A number of people have been asked this weekend. Claire Byrne, Francis Fitzgerald is one, what they thought of the Chancellor of the Exchequer openly weeping in Parliament. There seems to be a 50-50 split. Some are saying people have emotions and the fact that they express them in public is no bad thing. Others are saying, get a grip, it's the nation's parliament. Where do you stand, Francis?
Oh, look, the Iron Chancellor cries. I mean, it's the best story, you know, in terms of, you know, what you didn't expect from Rachel Reeves. And I think it's quite complicated because she said it was because of personal reasons, but we've no idea what they were. And then there's stories about having a fight with, you know, the chief whip, with the Speaker of the House and all the rest. But it was just so extraordinary that she just wasn't able to manage something that she's been dealing with for weeks in terms of the budget cutbacks. I don't think it could have been to do with the immediate reaction to Starmer not supporting her overtly at that point, although he did subsequently. And I just thought it was extraordinary that it just sort of burst out like that. I would think the public will be quite sympathetic. I don't think the Labour Party will be as sympathetic as the public will be.
Do you think the public will be sympathetic?
Rare. I do, actually, because I think, you know, politicians are so stereotyped in the public. But at the same time, when they see real emotion, I think people do kind of relate and react, say, oh, she's human, she's real. You know, so I think they'll be OK on it. I think politically it might be tougher for her. But it was just extraordinary. I found it extraordinary that at that moment she was so vulnerable. And there must have been a lead up to it. Because normally in politics, and I know when you're under pressure, there's a resilience that kicks in. And you fight. You may be stressed. You may be emotional. But you kind of get on with it because your life, your political life depends on it. And she didn't seem to be able to do that at that point. Now, I think there's a bigger issue for Labour because what they are doing is everything they're trying to do is so contra Labour values, Labour policy, cutbacks to welfare, to independent living. Like to try and save their 5 billion, they have gone to the heart of Labour values and they're going to have, and it's to deal with reform. They're going to have to, you know, sort that out and work out how do they make these cutbacks.
They're getting hammered in the polls because of
it. I mean, it's a bit like what we were facing in 2011. And they are paying the price for, you know, going after welfare.
What about the issues of potential misogyny in this, Kabir? Because there is obviously a gender subtext that doesn't get spoken about.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you have these fantastic moments from the point of view. They're very, very real. And to see her in during Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons, the issue I think there is the difference between House of Commons and Leader's Questions in Dáil Éireann is you cannot leave. So you're stuck there. So if you're bawling, if you're crying, if you've just gotten some bad news, you can't go anywhere. And of course, people will say, well, look, is she too emotional for the job? But I think she was really being herself. She's obviously had a horrendous morning. She probably didn't sleep very much the night before. She's trying to get through these welfare reforms that Labour is very keen on. The backbenchers were openly revolting. I mean, they were coming for everybody, including Keir Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, a Cork man, of course, plastered all over the papers in really quite personal attacks, saying we need a regime change. And I think it all got a bit too much for her. The damage control from all of this was the next day. They had this NHS event with herself and Keir Starmer, and Rachel Reeves was all dolled up and she had the makeup on and she was in good form then. But like, no doubts, everybody, your average punter who maybe doesn't know anything about politics, will see those images, those videos, and they will remember them. And it's those couple of moments that really define, I think, a party's term in government. Another similar moment is when Rishi Sunak announced the general election last time. He was getting absolutely lashed on. Everybody remembers that clip. Yeah. And I think that's what really cuts through to your average person.
Father Sabine, when's the last time you cried in public?
God, it's been a while. probably last Sunday when Meath won in the match. No, but listen, politics is...
Too emotional.
Like, I have cried in politics. There's no way you can get through politics without being emotionally invested. If you're a conviction politician, you know, it is... You're completely invested in what's happening. I think people want to see less staged, managed politics. I think people want to see real politicians. And one of the reasons why Trump actually does well in many ways is because he ditches the whole kind of, you know, the whole stage elements to it. And you know, I do think Labour definitely are snookered here in a significant way, because first of all, the majority is so skin deep. A small change, 2 or 3%, will completely obliterate them in the next election. The political spectrum has moved to the right, and they themselves need to move to the right to be able to deal with that. But as Francis says, that's completely opposed to the major cultural values. It's interesting that Corbyn now is looking to actually set up an alternative left-wing political party, which again, if it takes 2 or 3% off the Labour vote, will do further damage to Labour Party in the next election.
Well, that thing of splitting the vote is interesting, because that's now what Elon Musk is trying to do. Pick a couple of specific Senate seats, create a party and find a way to divide the Republican vote. Interesting, the texts are summarising pretty much 50-50. Anton, that crying woman should have got a grip. We all know women use tears as a weapon. Good Lord. Rachel's human after all, which goes to the point that is, I think many are making. Now, Gabia, your paper this weekend has a, list of former politicians has arrived in of people who have cried. Barack Obama. Obama cried openly while defending his executive actions on gun control. Do you remember after the Sandy Hook elementary shooting?
That was about the tragedy, public? I think,
Narendra Modi, Prime Minister of India, reportedly broke down during his first speech. And apparently historical accounts indicate that Winston Churchill was also known to shed tears on occasion. That may have been because he was inebriated the vast majority of time.
Jacinda Ardern, I think, cried when she resigned, didn't she as well?
Margaret Thatcher. There was the start of some weeping.
Margaret Thatcher did.
DJ Carey and the case during the week. Kabir, your paper has detail on this. It has an interview, thanks to Niamh Horan, with
Sarah Newman.
Thank you. His former partner. And the revelations are something else.
Yeah, really quite interesting stuff here from Niamh Horan. Sarah Newman really shining a light into what the relationship was like, and you know, she trusted him, and then it all started to unravel, and really quite spectacularly so. You know, she's made, I suppose, the most serious allegation that she makes is she says how she made a number of complaints back in 2012 about DJ's conduct, lies and deception to the Gardaí, but she's saying, you know, I don't think that I was fully listened to because of his status as a hurling star at the time. And of course, it was 11 years before he was charged in 2023 with a number of offences.
And she says she found out through a neighbour. Is that right?
Yeah, she's basically saying, look, I was one of the first people to raise the alarm on it. You know, she says, I don't think I was heard, and therefore lies the problem. One of the interesting anecdotes that she tells as well in the interview is on this Range Rover that DJ was given from a friend, and the friend said, look, here's the brand new car, and, you know, you will pay me for it, but I'm giving it to you in good faith. And the checks were coming in, and the checks all effectively bounced. And it wasn't until the businessman rang Sarah Newman. He was like, God, you're unbelievable. You're not paying for the car. And she was like, you know, what are you talking about? So, like,
apparently he also added, I know that DJ's getting treatment, but nonetheless, he should be paying. DJ Carey had told him that he had an inoperable brain tumor that he had made up as a way to sort of distract from bouncing checks.
And of course, that's the excuse that he used to effectively swindle money out of people. And it's really quite a sad story, I think, that we're hearing unraveling this week. I mean, there was another businessman in the papers quoted over the week, and I think they were saying, look, I gave him about 10 grand. He came to me looking for help. And it's just incredible how it's all unraveled and the amount of people that have gotten hurt in the process. And it's not one or two. It seems to be really quite many.
That the sadness that you raised, that's one of the things when you begin to look at all of the charges against him and all of the anecdotes of the victims. Obviously, it is immoral. Obviously, it is unethical. Obviously, it is illegal. It also seems very dim because you sort of look at it and think, how did he think he was going to get away with this?
It is desperate fall from grace. It's incredible to think that, like, he was such a hero for so many people, and he was involved then in a pathway of lies that was a cul-de-sac in the end of it. In the end of the day, he could go nowhere for it. But the truth is
But if your opening lie is, I have an inoperable terminal brain tumour, it does start a clock ticking.
It has to be found out at some stage. But there are bad characters in every walks of life in terms of politics and sport, etc. And the key to this is that undue deference is not a good thing. You know, we can't, you know, just take the face value of individuals just because they're famous or because they're celebrities.
Oh, but it's one of those, we all get punished for our kindnesses, though. The amount of people who are must be saying, I tried to do something decent for somebody
desperately
and got fleeced.
Sad, but she's now saying she was one of the main victims. And I think she obviously felt there was a need for her to come out, because I think she was stereotyped at the time too. And so this is her saying, I was a victim too. And the lies, and she was completely taken in by them. But the interesting point about the story is that she did report it way before some of the other victims had, you know, had fallen to him. And these personal stories are fascinating, that she chose to speak at this time. And she feels that people could have been protected. And if deference is the point you're making, Heather, that she, you know, that
she tried to sound the alarm.
She tried to sound the alarm, wasn't heard. And has now done this interview with Niamh. It's a very interesting interview.
And of course, it also details the amount that he had written off from debts to, I think, AIB as well. Millions that got written off.
He was dealt with very favourably. His sports status clearly helped him a lot, as it often does. And there's a lot of personal stories in the newspapers today. They're predominantly personal stories today, like Kathy Kelly speaking about her cancer, which is an amazing interview following on from Kate Middleton speaking about life after cancer. And how it doesn't actually quite return to normal, and the impacts. Very good personal stories.
The thing about cancer, and I think this is why DJ Carey was so successful in getting people to trust him and to give him money, is cancer that is something that has touched nearly everybody in the country. And it's very, very personal to people who either have had experience with it themselves or they've seen their friends or family suffer with it. And so when somebody comes to you that you admire, that you trust, and they tell you, look, I'm really
ill. Your heart goes out to them.
Your heart goes out to them, and you say, you know, of course I'll help you in whatever way I can.
More weeping updates. Nixon apparently wept both as a senator and a vice presidential candidate. He was reported to have cried after a meeting with Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. Clinton, Bill, as president, moved to tears during a gathering of health legislation supporters, and George W. Bush crying during a Medal of Honor ceremony for a Marine corporal. His dad, H.W. Bush, tearfully recalling moments leading to the start of the air war against Iraq in a 1999 speech, and he cried after his wife, Barbara Bush, had open-heart surgery.
And there's a book in this, quite clearly.
The ones who don't cry are much
Anton,
more
a new life.
Text saying, Rachel Reeves had no problem pointing and mocking the opposition right up until her job was questioned by the opposition. Then we got tears flowing. If you want to get in touch, 087 1400 106 or 53106 on text. That'll cost you 30 cents. Want to get former Minister for Justice Francis, your view on the story in the front of the Sunday Times. Gardaí Act over anti-Israel chant at the US Embassy. This is a group of people who gathered outside the US Ambassador's residence in the Phoenix Park when he was throwing the 4th of July barbecue and had a lot of invited guests and dignitaries. And among the chants was the one from Glastonbury, death, death, death to the IDF, and now apparently the Gardaí are getting involved. Should the Gardaí be getting involved in investigating chants, even if they're offensive?
I think most people's instinctive reaction, and my reaction, is if people are in a protest and they say something, you know, that is probably offensive to X number of the population and, you know, is kind of edgy, that you don't get involved. But then the question becomes, at what point do the Gardaí get involved? And at what point does it go beyond the ordinary protest chance to something that will incite violence against a specific person? This is a political chant, and I think it is up for debate to what degree is it incitement to violence. And this was, I wasn't
because
in the
dog. Because it's a mass entity rather than an individual.
Possibly. I think this is, I mean, you dealt with the hate speech in the Dáil,
yeah,
and these were the kind of issues that came up about what is the dividing line. Instinctively, if people are on a protest, people say all sorts of things. Mm. But when do you get to the point where you say, no, we're not having this in our society because it is going to lead to danger?
So this is very interesting, because when the hate speech bill was coming through the Dáil, I was making the points. Oftentimes people in political parties think hate speech is for other people. Okay, so it's never going to be turned at them. And I was trying to make the point that actual fact, hate speech is a threat to the right, the centre and the left. It's a threat to everybody in politics. And the reason being, for example, like Simon Harris has been called by the foreign minister of Israel an anti-Semite. He has been accused of hate speech. Simon Harris and the whole government have been accused by US senators of hate speech, of being anti-Semitic. So hate speech can be directed at anybody at any given time. So we have to be very, very careful in relation to it, because, you know, the whole idea of a democracy is the competition of ideas. The best ideas percolate to the top and people can see those best ideas and then choose the policies for the government. Now, I will say it frustrates me when I see the front page of a newspaper talk about sentences that are said, while at the same time we have 54,000 people killed in Gaza. To a certain extent, when you look at all the columnists...
Yeah, they didn't go to the US embassy and chant in the hope that they would get ignored.
No, but I just look at what all the column inches that were filled with Glastonbury, and yet none of what happened in Glastonbury was as wrong as people, women and children being killed in Gaza, which seems to get less. Now, I do think that Ruth Coppinger was wrong to say she agreed with the sentence, death to the IDF. I think that's...
Just to give the actual quote, what she said was, in relation to the chant, death to the IDF, what's the problem with that? As a collective, it's breaching all international laws as found by the International Criminal Court. Of course we wanted to stop. We wanted to end. To die metaphorically. I don't see the problem with that chant. That's what Ruth Coppinger said.
I am a proponent of freedom of speech, but I think a politician should have enough cop on to that the actual sentence itself should not be repeated by the politician in those. Because where the line between freedom of speech exists is incitement to violence. And, you know, this is on the way towards incitement to violence. Now, while it's not a direct and practical incitement to violence, because it's not going to have a direct outcome when said...
But does that not render the first half of that point moot? If it's not going to have an impact...
I'm not saying that those people should be arrested. I'm not even saying it should be on the front page of the newspaper. I'm just saying a parliamentarian should have more sense.
No, but my point being about the hate speech, is it hate speech if it can have no material impact by your own assessment?
No, so what I'm saying is I don't think anybody at the Phoenix Park should be arrested or censored legally in terms of what was said there. But I do think that a parliamentarian needs to have a standard in terms of how they engage with these issues.
What do you think, Abhi?
It's a difficult issue, and certainly when you see the headlines that are being made now the whole time by NECAP, for example, you know, they at a gig chanted, you know, kill your MP. I think the police in the UK are investigating that. Obviously, they've made other statements in their concerts as well. And then we had death to the IDF at Glastonbury. And obviously the Israeli side of this is very reactive to it. And they'll straight away say this is very anti-Semitic, because of course, if you grow up in Israel, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, you have to go and serve in the IDF. It's mandatory conscription. So you could be calling for an entire, they say you're calling for an entire population to be killed. Or so, like, it is very difficult. And obviously protesters at the US embassy would say, no, we want the end to the conflict in Gaza, you know, and the Israelis for all the wrong that they've done. like, it is difficult to see what, I don't know if there's going to be much that comes out from the guards on this, for example. The other side of the coin is, of course, we do have the hate speech and the hate crime laws that were passing through government. Mm-hmm. They were lumped in together into one piece legislation in the last government. They were separated out. There was a lot of controversy. The hate speech side of this remains to be dealt with. And now the government is facing effectively threats from the EU Commission because the laws that are currently in place are so out of date. So the issue will have to be dealt with, and it's a very fine line. I think it'll be interesting to see especially how Jim O'Callaghan acts on it, because of course when Helen McEntee was in the Justice portfolio, he was very critical of her handling of hate speech. So it'll be interesting to see what tack he decides to take on it.
Yeah, so actually the European Union have given Ireland 2 months to basically comply with their desire for hate speech laws to be implemented, and that 2 months is finished on the 7th. So it's finished on Monday or Tuesday, and you know, there's a danger that the Irish government will be brought to court and will be fined as a result of that.
For not having complied with the hate speech element.
The European Union is overstepping the mark in relation to that, because the reason why the government stopped in their tracks in terms of hate speech is because they know that Irish people do have an opposition to censorship, and hate speech can actually fall into censorship in places.
Well, by definition.
But the EU Commission, what they want is that if, and this would fit it actually, if it's directed at a group. And that's what they say, we haven't dealt with in Irish legislation. Mm. Now, this is directed at a group, obviously, to the IDF. So not under necessarily under Irish law at the moment, but under EU law, that would be seen as incitement.
So my point in this, the left were fully behind the hate speech laws when they were being proposed. And now these laws are now being directed at the left. And that's the danger here. Yes. So no matter where you are in a political spectrum, censorship has never been a good decision
in a
democracy.
There's obviously a direct connection between the harshening and the coarsening of an overall political discourse and the catalyzing of bad actors who are subject to this discourse. Is there good evidence to say that one individual incitement of hatred, one instance of hate speech, ever has cause and effect? Do we think that actually changes people? I mean, if we take the IDF thing, do we think anybody would do anything based on hearing a bunch of people outside the US embassy chanting that?
No, but it's exaggerating and highlighting, and it's kind of pointing towards them. But that's already in the public arena, like to such a degree. I don't think it does. But there's a question of how persistent and consistent it is, and then how it leads to, you know,
tricky to prosecute
public disorder, but very difficult.
The other side of it is, of course, for gay men, you know, who've gotten attacked in recent years on the streets of Dublin City. Like, they usually, it's hate speech that's then followed by an attack. Of course, the attacks are already illegal, but it does add an undercurrent to the assault.
And an acceptability or a...
I think the
algorithms in social media are probably the difficulty as well, because the algorithms often promote that level of hate and anger, and, you know, and that's a difficulty. So it's not that it's a level playing field on social media in terms of ideas. It's not. It's actually one side of the debate is often promoted, and that creates a problem.
Lastly, is there any issue of a counterintuitive effect? Because one of the issues is you create martyrs, I mean, metaphorical martyrs, but if you start to prosecute people for chanting things, by God, you draw attention to the chant.
So one of the reasons why we're seeing the difficulties within society at the moment is the lack of trust there is in authority. If you implement censorship laws, that by definition turbocharges that that lack of trust in the authority, and that actually works against the objective.
There's also a continuum. Do you then go on to, for example, songs? I mean, if you look at some of the Irish songs we've had, is it incitement to X or Y?
Well, it's art, then. The question arises on art.
It's very disturbing, the idea of interfering with sort of free expression and free speech.
Mm. Interesting text. Say, we have an anti-Semitism problem in Ireland that nobody wants to recognise, let alone admit. We're nice, we're Irish, we couldn't possibly be anti-Semitic, seems to be the attitude. 53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. Thank you to Padraig Tobin, leader of AINTHU, Francis Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach and member of the advisory group to the G7, and Gabia Gadavascacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent and Sunday Independent.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.